Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and we're going to be talking about plant diseases today, ways to keep your plants healthy, and what to do when maybe they've started looking a little wilty or yellow or having some other problems. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, thanks for coming in.
No problem. Glad to be here.
And Liz Freemuth is the owner of a concierge gardening service called The Garden Ho. We're glad to have her with us, too. Thanks for coming in, Liz.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you guys have a lot of fun with what you do, but, you know, working with diseases all the time, what gets you excited about that?
What doesn't, right, Brian?
Yeah, I just like the biology of these sorts of organisms that cause plant diseases, and it's a lot of fun helping folks try to figure out what the problem is and how to take care of it. I mean, I really do get excited about the disease side of things, but I know for most of my clients, that's not what they are totally excited about, although it's fun teaching them about that sort of stuff because you can get them kind of excited about it after a while as well.
Well, and one of the things I think that's challenging is sometimes you deal with disease 1 year, and then, you know, it seems like a long winter and you assume that everything gets killed off, and then all of a sudden the next year there you are again with the same problems or similar problems, or it seems to have moved to another part of the garden. Liz, how do you counsel people to get rid of what's causing, what's underlying diseases, so they can really start fresh that next season?
It really depends on the client and what their end goal is as to how you counsel them and which direction they go. Most of the time, people really care about their landscapes. If they're calling me or if they're sending samples to Brian, they really care about the health of it. And explaining to them the items that must be changed, whether it's cultural practices, whether it's chemical applications, explaining the why and the wherefore often gets them where they need to be in their head to understand, okay, this is what I need to do to treat it. And then also how long it might take, because you, as you said, it might show up now in 3 weeks. You may not even notice that it had a problem. And so it's really explaining to them what they can expect as time goes. And we do have to make that call periodically of, yeah, one pruning cut is needed, and that's Brian's favorite ground level pruning.
Would that be just hacking it off at the ground level?
Sometimes the best option for certain types of diseases is to replace the plant, and that's oftentimes hard for folks. And it's, I've always told, I tell my graduate students, when I talk to graduate students in my department, I said the two courses that I wish I'd had more of when I was a plant pathology major would have nothing to do with plant pathology. I would love to have had a business course, because I run a clinic where we actually charge, and having some business background would be great. But the other thing I would love to have would be more psychology courses, because you actually act as a counselor sometimes to folks. They get very attached to particularly trees. Old trees are like members of the family. And so sometimes it's just a matter of listening to them as they actually kind of mourn for the loss of a family member.
And it's not even just that emotional mourning, but it's the financial mourning too that comes, that whole process of grief that they go through is then, you know, you're dealt that blow at the end of it with, here's $1,500, that's what it costs to take that tree down. And so there is an awful lot of interaction that needs to go on in order for clients to be very happy in the end result.
Yeah,
definitely.
I was just talking to a client this morning who was concerned about oak wilt. He had just bought a property and had a lot of oaks and was concerned that he might have a problem. And he was really gung-ho on trying to treat as much as possible for that particular disease. And after we talked for a bit, I said, you know, there are a lot of things that you can do, but they're quite expensive. So you really have to decide whether you have the finances to do that sort of thing. Sometimes the only thing you can do is let the disease run its course. On the other hand, we can provide other options that if people have a little bit of money to spend to do it.
I have to say that emotional element is really interesting and not something that you necessarily think of. When we bought our house, the people that we bought it from had two rows of Sharon bushes that were from the wife of the couple's grandfather's garden. Now, this is this is someone I only met in buying the house from her, certainly never met her grandfather. And I felt this huge responsibility to keep these rows of Sharon bushes going. And they are often late bloomers. And so I'm always worried, they didn't make it through the winter. And in fact, one didn't make it through that really bad winter with lots of ice and things like that. But I feel this emotional connection to these plants just because of the story that I was told about them.
Sure, and there are lots of stories like that.
Yeah,
and I have put my foot in my mouth over something like this. I remember one person bringing in a pin oak sample, and they're very prone to a problem called chlorosis, where if the soil pH is too high, they don't get enough iron, and they get very yellow leaves with these dark green veins. And this elderly woman with her daughter came in, and she held up this leaf of a pin oak, and I went into my, this is chlorosis, and that's absolutely the worst possible tree to have for chlorosis. And then they explained it had been planted as a memorial to the elderly woman's husband. And so I had to kind of backtrack and apologize and talk with them. And we discussed it for a long period of time about what they might be able to do in terms of managing that tree. But I finally kind of convinced them that if they wanted something that was a memorial to the woman's husband and that was going to last and be healthy for a long, long time, long beyond when either her or her daughter might be alive, that another tree choice was probably a better option. And I think I had them convinced by the time we were done that, yeah, they were going to plant something else.
And really, it's so important. And you and I have both learned this through the years. It's so important to ask that question towards the front of a discussion is, does this have sentimental value?
Yeah.
Because you would never, it happens. You would never do that intentionally. I would never do it intentionally to offend someone in a memorial or if it's even just a Christmas cactus that was one of grandma's or something like that. Yeah, yes, then oftentimes people are willing to go to great lengths to save a plant. And, you know, we're happy to work with them and do what we can if that's what they want to do. And, you know, like you felt the responsibility to keep those plants going. And
I felt I bought into the responsibility.
Yeah. It's a huge responsibility because Mama Nature plays with us and we can try all we want. And sometimes it doesn't do much good.
Well, we're going to definitely talk about, like you said, choosing from the beginning what those better varieties are. So you have more of a chance, but I want to make sure people know that they can call in with their questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. Jennifer Dargan is our on-air producer today, and she'll be answering the phone and forwarding your emails on to us. And let's go to the phone right away. Actually, we have Janine in Milwaukee on the line. Hi, Janine.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question today is about my parents' peach tree in Shorewood. They live kind of close to the lake. They've got a disease on this tree, and my husband wants to transplant this tree to our backyard in Bayview. And I'm just wondering if it's worth it. It's got this sort of brownish red bubbling thing going on that's kind of taken over the leaves, and I'm not sure. We really don't know what kind of disease it is, but I guess it's been getting worse over the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I would suggest would be if it's a leaf disease like that, is getting it diagnosed first. You say it's kind of bumpy on the leaves. Is that correct?
Yeah, the leaves they come in green
and
they look good, and then but as they get a little older, the leaves they start to like bubble up. It's kind of like cringing.
And this is a peach. Did you say it was a peach? Yeah.
It's a peach tree.
It's probably a disease called peach leaf curl. And it almost makes the leaves look like seersucker fabric with all those puckers. It's quite distinctive. It's a fungal disease. It's very, very common on peach. And we do have a fact sheet on that particular disease that's available. I'll give out a website sometime during the hour where you can find that. You can treat for that particular disease. What you would need to do would be to make a series of applications of a copper-containing fungicide that you would apply when the trees are dormant. You can either do that in the fall after the leaves have fallen from the tree or in the spring before the trees have leafed out. And you might have to do that more than one time. And what you're trying to do is kill off the fungus. It tends to overwinter in the branches. And if you can do enough of those applications, you can get the amount of the fungus down to a level where you will not see a lot of problems on the leaves. This isn't a lethal disease, typically. And so it is treatable.
What is it called again?
It's called peach leaf curl.
Peach leaf curl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And interestingly, we see another variation of the disease. It's called plum pockets. If you ever have a plum tree that gets these really spongy looking fruits, it's actually a very closely related fungus that causes that as well. It's the same sort of treatment. In terms of transplanting, how large is the tree?
That's the thing. I mean, it's already about 20 feet tall.
In my mind, is way too big to be thinking about transplanting it. Yeah. You're going to, if you try to do that, you're going to cut off a substantial proportion of the root system, and it's not going to survive particularly well. Peaches tend to be a little bit marginal
in Wisconsin.
Although in your area, it's a little milder in the winter, but still, I would be concerned about that.
You still need an awful lot of protection. And with a tree that size, you're talking about a tree spade. You're looking at a tremendous cost to have it moved. Being it's grandma's tree, you may want to incur that, but you have to have somebody come in with a fairly large tree spade in order to accomplish that. So is it in an area that would be accessible by a large truck?
Yeah, and, my husband kind of loves the challenge.
Well, you know what? If he loves a challenge...
The question is, does he love the expense?
Yeah, you know what? If he loves a challenge, there are some wonderful websites that you can go to that will help you calculate what size root mass you should be taking based on the caliper of the tree, the diameter of the tree at chest height. So you can actually, I love somebody who likes a challenge. So I would say, contact some tree movers, and now is not a good time to do that. I would do that in late fall after dormancy or very early in spring. That you've got, if you do it in fall, you have to allow yourself enough time to get some roots established so that it doesn't go into drought stress over winter. So, I said late fall, but it's like late summer. We would be looking at August or so. And if the weather is really dry and hot, I would say hold off until March or so and do it in February, March.
Yeah, keep in mind that the root system of that tree, if it's a 20-foot tree, could go out 100 feet from the trunk.
Yep.
So root systems are quite extensive. And even if you take a huge root mass with a big tree spade, you're still going to lose a fair proportion of the roots.
And there is a process involved in this that if it has not been root pruned up to this point, you will want to do a little bit of study. This is where if your husband likes a challenge, here we go. You're going to want to do some root pruning throughout the year and maybe even into next year. If you're not in a hurry to move this, you've got plenty of time to work with it. And anybody who is really competent at tree moving will help you through this process if you can't find the information on your own. And anytime you're dealing with plant health, whether that's either moving a tree, planting a tree, go look for a certified arborist. And I know, Brian, you know the website. It's like ISA.
www.waa-isa.org That's for the Wisconsin Arborist Association, and you can look up a certified arborist who will be qualified and will be working in your area of the state. And there are a lot of good folks down in your area.
Oh, absolutely. Great. Absolutely.
Well, it sounds, I'm guessing that this discussion in Janine's house has not ended.
I mean, the other option might be, I don't know how well peaches graft, but that might
you
be another
graft.
Plant your own tree in your yard, a smaller tree which has a larger likelihood of surviving, and then graft some of the branches from grandma's tree onto that.
And that's an excellent suggestion. In fact, I would say do all of the above so that you've got your bases covered.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like quite a project. So thanks for the call, Janine. And let's go to Bonnie in Blue Mound. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I have a question about garden peppers.
Okay.
I have three varieties in my garden. I put them in about 2 weeks ago, and I didn't suffer any of the frost that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in different parts of the garden. So one is a Marconi, one is a sweet banana, and then I have one plant of a hot pepper, like a jalapeno. And about 5 days ago, I started noticing some yellowing on the lower leaves that actually went to brown in places, and a couple of leaves have fallen off. And I did have tomato blight in my garden, and I haven't grown any tomatoes for about 2 years to try to clean it out. And I'm wondering what you would suggest. And
yeah, I'm wondering whether part of the problem might be it's been relatively cool here recently, and peppers tend to like a little bit hotter temperatures. Mm-hmm. So it may simply be the fact that the weather hasn't been optimal for peppers to be growing. And sometimes that can influence nutrient uptake, which can lead to leaf yellowing and browning. So it may just be kind of a waiting game to let the warmer temperatures come, and they may do a little bit better. You might want to consider a soil fertility test just to see whether your fertility levels are adequate for that sort of crop. And the Soil and Plant Analysis Lab, which is on the west side of Madison, can help you with that sort of testing. And then based on the recommendations you can make, you can fertilize the garden appropriately.
Can I ask you, when the yellow leaves started turning brown, were they spotty, or was it the entire leaf, the outside edges? How did they brown?
The outside edges.
Hmm.
And then it kind of worked its way into the more of the center of the leaf, but mostly just the outside edges. And I did put, when I planted them, like a teaspoon of Osmocote.
Mm-hmm.
Fertilizer,
right
when I planted and watered.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it may be a temperature issue that it's just the roots just aren't functioning particularly well
because
it's been cool.
Yeah, when you get those cool evenings, peppers and tomatoes are tropical-loving like plants. So as soon as you get down underneath 50 degrees at night, you're going to set them back somewhat. If you have evenings, and I would think you probably would, Blue Mound you're from, I would think you're going to have some cooler evenings here, yet you may want to get out something to put over them, unless you've got like 400 of them that you're covering. If it's only a matter of two or three, you may want to put a cardboard box over them in the early evening if nights are going to be cool. You may not get the frost damage, but you will get them set back by that cool evening temperature. And you know,
want to kind of insulate them to keep a little bit of warmer air.
Yeah, a little bit. And active temps for leaf fungi is, we were right at that.
It really ranges depending upon the fungus, but the pattern that you're talking about doesn't sound like a
Mm-mm.
typical leaf blight pattern because it's marginal. Usually if we have fungal diseases that are attacking leaves, it's going to be a little bit more random on the leaf. So I think it's more of an environmental nutrient sort of issue, and it may just be a waiting game just to allow things to warm up. The other thing you might want to consider sounds like you're a really avid gardener and you like to get things out early would be to look into building some cold frames.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then that'll help insulate and keep those plants a little bit warmer. My dad's great at doing this. He's done this for years, and he gets things out very early in his garden. He has a lot of success, but he's keeping them warm in those early parts of the spring when it's a little bit cooler.
And, some of the materials out there now are so easy to make little hoop houses with. You get some bendable plastic stakes and get those in the ground, and very easy to do.
And it is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry today with Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, and Liz Freemuth, who is a horticulturalist and worked with Walworth County previously, and now the owner of The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants, providing concierge horticulture services. You're listening to us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about plant diseases and diagnostics on Garden Talk today. And if you have a question, please give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you have a question about a disease and you happen to have a picture of what's going on, you can post that on our Facebook page and Brian and Liz can take a look at it.
Sure.
And then they won't be guessing quite so randomly. we did that especially with the bird watching show we did on Monday. And it was great. And people got a lot of really good information. Now, Bonnie in Blue Mounds had brought up an interesting question. Now that we've got a lot of our seeds and they're sprouting, or we've put plants in the grounds, what are possible disease signs we should be looking out for? And what are just kind of, normal things going on?
Yeah, if you're seeding a lot and growing plants from seeds, and it's particularly what I look a lot for, damping off, which is a very early disease that occurs as the plants are just coming up. There'll be an infection, the lower stems will collapse, and the plants kind of fall off onto the soil, and that will kill them. The main thing with that is to try to keep things relatively dry. You need enough moisture for the plants to germinate, or the seeds to germinate, and for them to grow vigorously, but you definitely want to keep things a little bit on the drier side. It also helps to plant when it's a little warmer, because the plants will actually mature past a point where they'll get those sorts of infections. I think some of the diseases that I'm expecting to see are carryovers from last year. We've seen a lot of problems with conifers, with needle diseases. I think we're going to see some powdery mildews coming up because certainly here in the Madison area, it was very hot and muggy last week, and that high humidity is great for powdery mildews.
We've already seen the start of that down in the southern part of the state. So,
and definitely. I saw a Diablo, I don't know if it was Diablo 9 bark, but a 9 bark sample that
more
came
than
in
likely
that had powdery mildew. That's a real susceptible variety. I think we're going to see a lot of leaf diseases on trees as well, because we've had a fair amount of rain in many areas of the state, and the cool, rainy weather is very conducive for those sorts of problems.
I've been seeing a lot of, as you said, conifer needle paths that are all over the place, but also discoloration. And again, because of the cool, the wet, we've got sunny days, not sunny days. Plants are a little confused. What I've really noticed very pronounced fashion this spring has been the difference in leaf out in trees. We have some that are, they're just junk trees. So it might be box elder or mulberry that are 2 weeks behind everything else. And that's not generally the case in a particular area. So really things that have happened in the last year are starting to come to fruition now. And we will see some major stresses on some of the shade trees definitely this year.
So are plants like people in the sense that if they're stressed, they're more susceptible to things? And in a way, like their immune systems get compromised. Yeah. Like we get a cold after, finals exam week as a student or something like that.
Yeah, they don't have immune systems like we do. But the stress comment is very right on target. We tend to see an increase in diseases when they're water stressed, when they're nutrient stressed, if they're cold stressed, temperature stressed, it does make a difference about the level of disease that you see. Mm-hmm. And there's some very good documentation. There's one particular disease of Austrian pine called Diplodia tip light that there's very good research that indicates that if you put Austrian pines under water stress, you get more disease, more infections per plant, and the disease progresses more rapidly in those sorts of stressed trees. So there is a lot of truth to that.
Mm-hmm. We had an email from Marty in Madison. I have a row of cedars along the front of my property in Lodi. All of them are dying. I've noticed that every single cedar tree along any road in Wisconsin is dying. What's going on? Is there anything that can be done to stop this?
If it's along roads, my first question would be how much salt they use on those roads, because we do get a lot of salt splash coming off of highways. And I saw a lot of this. I was on the road the last couple of days along the interstates in the state, and there are a lot of brown conifers, not only cedars, but everything under the sun. And if there's a lot of splash of salt up onto those trees, it will dehydrate the needles. The other problem that we see is the salt running off the road and into the root zone, and that will actually interfere with water uptake. So again, that'll lead to needle browning. Some of it could be just a result of what we call winter injury, which salt can exacerbate, but that particular problem is really a problem with the plants not having enough water stored internally as they go into the winter time. And so they just kind of run out of water as we go through the winter. And it oftentimes is most pronounced, the development of those symptoms. Again, it's browning of the needles in the springtime as they're coming out of dormancy, because they start to use a little bit more water as the air temperature warms, but the root systems may be cold. In fact, the ground may not be thawed yet, and the roots can't take up sufficient water to replace what's being used. So I've seen a lot of that. I see that a lot on yews. I do see it on cedars, both red cedar, which is a type of juniper, and white cedar. I've seen it on actually a lot of spruces this year, which is a little unusual.
Yeah.
I've seen it on
spruce,
pines.
Spruce especially bad this year. White pine, another one that's been especially bad this year. And I think, you have the salt damage, but also what we have to remember is that there are chemicals being used all over the place, which if they don't take out a conifer, they will stress it, and the needles do suffer after a while. And that's just part of life. Mm-hmm. We are going to deal with that. That's what gets put on the farm fields, and it does have some impact. Yeah. Also, when the road crews go through and spray for weeds, depending on which way the wind is blowing from, we can have issues with that as well. But if you remember, we actually had kind of a dry fall last year, and it went from dry to not even going to that, we'll get a little snow, it'll melt, we'll get a little snow, it'll melt, get a lot of snow and it stays. We just went to, we'll get a lot of snow and it stays. And so the ground was actually pretty dry when the snow got on it. So those trees are stressed big time.
Depending upon the type of cedar, there's a difference between white cedar and red cedar. Red cedar is a type of juniper, and there are some diseases that can develop late season. There's a needle blight called Cabotina needle blight. It's a fungal disease. And those infections tend to occur late in the season, and then you see development of brown needles over the wintertime, and it shows up in the spring. And then we have another needle blight that starts at this time of the year, Phomopsis, and then you get more needle browning over the summer. So that could be part of it as well.
Hmm. Thanks for that email. And let's go back to the phones. Jeff in Chilton has a question. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I've got a question I've got a tree. It's a Prunus Schubert, and it's got that fungus disease called poop on a stick.
Yeah, that's you probably heard that from something I've said, because I talk about that all the time with master gardeners. It's not the true name of the disease, but I think it's so descriptive that people will recognize it if you call it that.
Well, and our on-air producer Jennifer Dargan actually Googled it to make sure, and she found it. So it's out there.
The technical name is black knot. And it's a fungal disease. It's specific to Prunus species, so plums and cherries, and not only edible plums and cherries, but any of the ornamentals as well.
And you'll see it in the wild. You'll see it in cultivated.
That's typically the wild kind of volunteer cherries and plums are typically where the fungus is hanging out most of the time, where the spores are coming from that'll attack our ornamentals and our fruit Prunus trees. The best way to deal with it, this is one of these issues where, one, how severe is the disease? Do you have a lot of it in your trees?
Well, I noticed it, I think 2 years ago, and I've just been, you know, pruning it out and burning the branches. But the problem I have now is it's actually on the main trunk itself, about 5 feet up the trunk.
Well,
how
big is your tree, and how large around are you expecting the trunk of that tree to get eventually?
Well, I'm unsure what the mature size is supposed to be. Right now, it's probably about maybe 4 or 5 inches in diameter.
Okay.
It is suckering profusely, as I'm sure you know they're good for. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if maybe I should just cut the whole tree down and just let one of the suckers come up.
You can do that. The reason I was asking the size of the tree is that if you have a large tree with one of those knots on the trunk, if you cut down the tree, save it, and find a local woodworker, they will pay lots and lots of money for one of those large galls, because woodworkers will make bowls out of those. And we had one that was on a trunk that was maybe 6 inches in diameter, and it was about a 6-inch diameter gall on that trunk. And we had somebody offer us, we took it up to the garden, to the farmer's market, just as a demo prop, and somebody offered one of the master gardeners $150 for it. So they can be quite valuable, but that sounds like a smaller tree, and it's probably not going to get that big. So if you're not emotionally attached to the tree, I would say go ahead and cut it down and replace it with something else. You'll probably want to go with a non-prunus, because it sounds like you're probably in an area where there's a fair amount of inoculum floating around. So you may want to select some other type of flowering tree.
Thanks for that, Jeff. And also, that brings up a good question, I think. So where do these diseases hide? You know, what do you have to get rid of from season to season to make sure that you're not going to be reliving that every time you plant something?
Yeah, lots of times it can be either living plant tissue. So in the case of black knot, it's going to be in other cherries and plums that are somewhere in the area. And if you're in a more rural area, birds are everywhere. They eat cherries and plums, and they will poop out the seeds. And so they come up everywhere, and definitely you're going to have a source of inoculum from those volunteer plants. For herbaceous plants, lots of times pathogens are surviving in old plant debris. So if you had an infection in your leaves last year and those old leaves have died and are sitting on the soil, that's where the fungus is going to come from. The cold temperatures in the winter just don't kill these organisms off. So good fall cleanup is actually one of the cultural practices that we recommend to reduce disease problems.
And I'm not one of those that says go out and vacuum your lawn and things like that. But this is one instance where it is really a good idea, if you've got a plant that had a problem, to get out there with the leaf vac and get as much debris up as possible. It's such a simple thing to do.
Right.
And yet it will help break the cycle. It's like anything. If you can break the cycle, and one of the biggest things in breaking any cycle, whether that's disease, insect, et cetera, is know your enemy. And so that means get it identified so that you can pinpoint or have Brian pinpoint what the point is that you need to stop. You know, you need to stop that cycle, and where's the best interruption?
And I tend to be a person who doesn't get to good fall cleanup myself, but I try to do it in the spring. Part of me wants to leave some of that material there because it's an insulator. And lots of times we do need that insulation over the winter time. So I tend to do more of my cleanup in the spring when I get to it. I'm pretty bad, but I like diseases in my yard because
I'm kind of lazy myself. And I had somebody email me and say, "Oh, I bet you have a beautiful landscape." It's like, no, it's pretty much a deathscape, because I really do stress things out in my yard. And so if somebody's coming to steal plants, don't steal them from my yard, because I'm like Brian. I'm kind of, you know, I put the junipers next to the crab apples to see if I can get big galls on them. And I still have one. I can't get to grow a gall on it for life of me. And so if you're going to take some, don't take it from my yard, please.
You'll be stealing diseases.
You will be stealing something
well,
you don't
and don't
want.
They say that the cobbler's children are the worst shad or something? So you're just living up to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we really do. I mean, we have to understand what things are going to look like in the process in order to figure out what you're looking at when you go to somebody's house. So oftentimes I will know that it's got an illness. I'll go and I'll buy a plant that I know is sick at the garden center, get it for $5 or something, and bring it home. But I will not do that for something that's going to be horribly invasive problem for somebody else. We're talking about relatively controlled diseases and problems. Anything else I leave to Brian?
I have to say, because of neighbors that have black walnut trees, I have to do a lot of container gardening. Mm-hmm, and while it can be a pain, it also means that I'm starting with a clean slate every year. And so that's a benefit, actually.
And we oftentimes do that for a particular people have had a lot of problems with tomato diseases. If they've grown tomatoes in the same place, there's a fungus called verticillium that can build up in the soil. A lot of the tomato leaf blight pathogens will survive pretty well. And sometimes the best option is to grow tomatoes in containers so that you can move them into a sunny area where they're going to dry rapidly and you're using fresh soil. The main thing that we do recommend if you're going to do potted plants is if you're buying a commercial potting mix, make sure you're getting one that's been pasteurized. And that means it's been steamed, and that steam process tends to kill off pathogens that happen to be in the soil mix.
We have a lot of people that want to ask questions, so let's go back to the phones to Donna in Milwaukee. Hi, Donna.
Hello. I have two questions about two different plants, and just to get it out of the way, let's go with my hollyhocks that got all these. They had a fungus last year. And somebody had recommended medium weight horticultural oil and I think it was baking soda, and I can't remember.
It depends on the disease. There is a mixture. What sort of symptoms were you seeing on the hollyhocks that made you think it had a fungal disease?
Well, it was. It started at the ground.
Okay.
And worked its way up to, leaves that just were turning yellow and dying, and you know, I just couldn't. I mean, there were beautiful flowers on top, and I was pulling off these awful-looking leaves.
Mm-hmm. What I would suggest before you go to all the effort of spraying would be if it starts to do that again this year, get a leaf into your county extension office. You're in the Milwaukee area, and you could go to the Milwaukee County Extension office, talk to one of their yard and garden line folks. Susie Orth is somebody who's with that program. The county extension horticulture agent is Sharon Morrissey. She could help you out as well. What I want to do is make sure that you're actually dealing with a disease problem here before you know, you start spraying anything, because it could be a fertility issue that can also lead to bottom up sort of loss to leaves. And there might be other issues that are non-disease related. And why spray a fungicide if you don't have to? The mixture that you're talking about, which is the oil and the baking soda, that is pretty specific for powdery mildews. And I don't usually think of hollyhock as being a plant that has really serious problems with that particular disease. Of the ingredients that were recommended, you want to use a lightweight horticultural oil, not a moderate or heavyweight horticultural oil. It needs to be as lightweight as possible. And that's because the horticultural oils, when you apply them to leaf tissue, they can be a little bit toxic, particularly if it's hot. And they'll cause a little bit of burn on its own. But our recommendation, if you do have powdery mildew and want to use this concoction, it's a tablespoon and a half of baking soda and 3 tablespoons of a lightweight horticultural oil in a gallon of water. And that needs to be sprayed before you start to see powdery mildew symptoms. And that's that real powdery white growth that'll occur.
Looks like frosting.
It looks like frosting.
I know exactly what powdery mildew looks like.
Okay.
I've seen that before.
Yeah. So did you see those sorts of...
A half of baking soda?
It's a tablespoon and a half of baking soda.
Three of
the lightweight horticultural oil.
And
a gallon of water. It's a gallon of water.
Okay, I have another question.
Okay.
This isn't my problem. It's my neighbor's.
But okay.
She thinks I can solve all horticultural problems, and I really...
Well, you know where to call. That's the first step.
There you go.
Well, you know, I walked down and saw her problem and thought to myself, gee, I don't want to tell her that her lilac bushes should be in hospice.
What's going on with the lilacs?
She has a whole line of lilacs along a south-facing fence. And things must have been happening with them long before she noticed. First of all, there's no, you know how lilacs send up those shoots on the mm-hmm. bottom? She has nothing like that. There's nothing like that going on. And so I think that's a very bad sign. And then secondly, she has branches that are, she obviously never cleared out anything old.
Mm-hmm.
Like you would if you have a lilac bush, you know, you don't just let it grow for 20 years and do nothing. But obviously they did, but there's a green, kind of a green bumpily fungi looking something on branches.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, yeah. It looks like you might have an idea what that is.
Yeah, well, I think probably there's some cultural things that need to be done with those shrubs first, and then we can talk about the material you're seeing on the branches.
Yeah, really, culturally, if these are true lilacs, they're not the Peking lilacs, you know, the ones that are just starting to set their blooms, those typically are single-stem lilacs. If you're talking about your garden variety lilacs that are just about all done blooming at this point in time, I would say drastic rejuvenation is in order, but you know that's something that you really have to come to terms with. You're okay to either do it over a few years or to have them look like the Dickens for a few years, because in order to promote some suckering, you really are going to have to stress that tree out a little bit and the bushes. So that means cutting them back pretty good. General renewal pruning, a third of the largest out. If you've got a shrub that has three main stems on it, take one out. And then over 3-4 years, you're going to clean those out and you will see some activity from the base. I would also say cutting them back from the top now is a good time to do that. And if you've got somebody who's happy with a chainsaw, let them just go at it and hedge the things and start from there. Because if you're talking about lilac bushes that really have not had any care for a long time, you're going to have to suffer the look for a few years while you get it back in order. Normally, they will grow and flower no matter what you do with them, but they do need a little bit of rejuvenation here and there.
Yeah, and then the bumpy things that you're talking about, it sounds like they're probably what are called lichens. And those tend to, they're not disease-causing organisms. They just like to grow on things. It's a kind of a funky symbiotic organism that's part fungus and part alga. And they grow on surfaces, and they oftentimes like branches. We see them oftentimes in declining trees and shrubs, but they're not causing the decline. I think what's going on is that as some of the branches start to decline, they start to get kind of leaky, so they leak nutrients onto the surface, mm-hmm. and these lichens like to grow in that more nutrient-rich sort of environment. And you actually, quite frankly, you want to see a lot of different kinds of lichens. The more different types of lichens you see, the better your air quality. So when people get really upset about seeing lichens, I said, they're a good thing. You want to see a lot of those. It's just that they are an indication that probably you have a shrub or a tree that may be in some decline, although they'll grow on perfectly healthy trees as well. But I think in your situation, they're given the age and the fact that the shrubs have not been probably maintained as well as they could have been maintained, you probably have some branches that are dying back in there, and they're probably preferentially colonizing those branches.
And I've had people ask me, well, can I bleach those spots off? It's like, no, don't do that. Don't do that. You know, just they're not going to bother anything. Check the tree or shrub for health, but you don't have to bleach them to get them off.
Right.
Enjoy them. You know, go and look at them and take a magnifying glass mm-hmm. out there and look at them up close, because they're really pretty awesome when you look at them
up
close.
It's just a different part of the landscape.
It
right?
is,
That's right.
Yeah.
You're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Glad to have you along. Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth are our guests today. If you have a question about a plant disease that you want to nip in the bud or want to prevent in the first place, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Thanks for listening to us here on the Ideas Network. It's Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Judith Sears-Poisson in for Larry Mueller, and we are talking about plant diseases, how to keep them healthy, how to take care of disease once it's happened, and how to avoid having the same diseases year after year in the garden. And Liz and Brian, we have several people that want to join in. So let's go to Jim in Menominee. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Jim?
We must have lost him.
All right, I think we lost Jim. Let's go to Lute in River Falls. Hi, Lute.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have what I think is powdery mildew. I've not had it before, and this is on the shrub that I just put in last summer.
Okay.
And it looks to me like you'd maybe take a little powdered sugar and sprinkle here
yeah,
and there.
Yeah, sounds like yeah. powdery mildew.
Yeah, I was listening to your last call in person, and I got the... you know, what you're supposed to use. My concern is I've already got it. You know,
no.
Okay.
What do you know what sort of shrub this is?
Oh, gosh. Of all of them that I saved the tag for, that's
what,
the one I didn't.
What does it look like?
It's got a lovely dark, dark leaf. It's green with a brownish, and it, the brown is part of the coloration. It's not like it's
probably kind of a reddish, sort of reddish green leaf.
Yeah, and
okay.
it's a flowering shrub, and right now it's just in bud.
Okay, just in bud. The flowers are in bud, or the leaves are just starting to come out?
The flower is in bud.
Okay, and do this are the stems kind of long and arching?
Yeah.
Okay, is it?
And the leaf is only, I'd say, you know, a little over an inch. It's a small leaf.
Does it have? Does it look kind of like a mini maple leaf with no points
yep.
on it?
Yep.
Okay, more than likely a physocarpus or a nine bark.
Yeah. That was my fear.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and now let me ask you, area that you have this in, does it get sun?
It gets sun. It gets morning sun.
Okay, and heavy shade in the afternoon or just a little bit?
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Does it get any heavy shade in the afternoon?
It does.
Okay, and have you pruned it out at all?
I haven't.
Okay, how old is this tree? How many years have you had it?
I just put it in last year.
Okay, oh, that doesn't bode well. You know what I would do? I would dig it up and move it, because
okay.
if you've only had it in for a year... and it you're already seeing powdery mildew, I would say it's not really fond of the conditions that you have it planted in. And typically we will see that get powdery mildew if it doesn't get a lot of airflow. It can actually tolerate quite a bit of airflow coming through, and that will help keep those pathogens moving, and it doesn't have a chance to really sit and do its business, not as much.
And dries things out.
That's it does, yes.
And the powdery mildew is really like lots of humidity, and you have to keep in mind that plants are little mini humidity generators. They actually lose a lot of moisture through the leaves, and it creates a little envelope of humid air around the leaf surface. And you want that good airflow to keep the pathogens moving and also get rid of that humid air so it's a little bit drier. Powdery mildew spores tend to dry out pretty quickly.
Yeah,
and nine bark, unfortunately, I bet if you went back and could find that tag, I would lay odds that it was probably a Diablo nine bark.
More
because
likely.
That's the variety that I tend to see really severe powdery mildew problems on. And I definitely agree with Liz's recommendation to move it to a location where there's better airflow and more sun so it dries out a little bit more.
And they will tolerate a bit of shade, because I've got one that really doesn't get much but a couple hours of sun in the afternoon. But that's enough, because that's afternoon sun, and that takes it dry into the evening. And if you can, and it gets a lot of airflow too, but I still see powdery mildew show up on that one every once in a while, and it's really kind of out in the open. So I would say, because it's relatively new, it's going to be easy to transplant. Now would be a good time to go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. They're really pretty tough, so you could move it now and just make sure it gets watered and mulched in pretty good.
The you may want to prune out the branches that are showing symptoms now, because if it is Diablo, I tend to see a lot of branch dieback with powdery mildews, which is very unusual. That's not something I normally see with the powdery mildew on other types of plants, but on this host, I do see that quite frequently. If you get it into a better environment,
I think it'll do better. You'll have fewer problems with powdery mildew. You could certainly, if you continue to have some issues with it, use the concoction that I mentioned earlier. And then if you just continue to have problems, then that's a situation where I would say consider replacing it with something else so you don't have all these maintenance issues.
Yeah, and you know, it's unfortunate because that plant offers a color in the landscape that's very difficult. It is, yeah. And the bark on the branches is wonderful. It adds another layer of interest for us for a very, 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 very long fall, winter, and spring season. So to find something that's going to be close to that may be a little bit difficult. A color range is really a toughie. But if you are looking for something, look at a black lace elderberry. Yeah, it gives you a black color, and there are problems with elderberries, but you can rejuvenate them fairly easy. You cut them back, and it's kind of the poor man's black Japanese maple, etc. That will work to a certain extent. There are some very nice red-leafed hazelnuts. Few problems with them, but they will grow in shade very easily, and I don't see powdery mildew as an issue with those. There's some blight and some insect issues, but you know, not always my first choice, but that color range is a difficult one to get plants
in. And I don't want to give the impression that you can't get this problem taken care of, because you may very well be able to do it, but just be prepared to, if you continue to have problems, you may want to consider a replacement.
And, you know, really, you know, I said take it out, move it. If you don't have a spot to move it and you want to try and work with it in that area, thin it out, spray it. You know, you do have a little bit of work ahead of you, but if that's something that you really are dying to keep it in that spot, then, you know, you can play with it. But I would look maybe 5 years down the road at shopping again, because you're going to get tired of it.
Thanks for that call. And Marcia emailed with a question that sounds somewhat similar. I brought rosemary in last year and it survived the winter, but this spring it started getting a white dust on it. I bought a couple other rosemary plants from the nursery and planted them all outdoors. Three out of the four of them have the white powdery stuff on them. They're not planted near each other and were not kept together at all. Is there anything I can do for the plants, or will this affect other plants in the garden?
Yeah, that's, it sounds like powdery mildew, and rosemary is very susceptible as well.
Especially this time of the year. I don't think I've overwintered a rosemary other than maybe 2 years where I haven't had an issue with it.
Mm-hmm. And you can cut those back and allow them to regrow, but you may want to consider, the baking soda oil concoction as a preventative treatment. You have to get it on before you start to see symptoms. And in this particular case, that involves cutting back and allowing it to regrow. Since you're talking about an edible plant, if you want to go with a more organic sort of option so you don't have to worry about, you know, issues of toxicity from the oil, you could potentially use something like canola oil as a substitute, but definitely you want to apply these oils when it's relatively cool, and you don't want to apply them like today. It's supposed to get to 90. I definitely would not be applying oils at that temperature. And I oftentimes, with any oil that you're going to be using on a plant, is suggest pre-treating a few branches. Don't treat the entire plant. Apply the material. Check a couple days later to see if you see any burn symptoms from the oil. If you don't, then it's probably safe to use that oil on the entire plant.
And I would suggest also that you give the plant a little flick with your finger and make sure nothing flies up from
That's
it.
That's true.
Because you can have some insects that will hit, especially coming out of greenhouses. Rosemaries are just magnets for that when they're in the greenhouse. And normally, once you move them outside, you trim them back a little bit, give them a couple good heavy-duty spritzes with a hose. Sometimes, you know, and treat with product if you have to. But sometimes that's enough just to get them released out, and the rosemaries will come back just fine. But give a little flick with your finger, make sure nothing flies off.
Yeah, and again, the same things we talked about, again, going back to powdery mildews that we talked about with the nine bark. Good aeration, good spacing. Again, you just want to remove that humid air from around the plant.
Thanks for that email. And Allison Gaze Mills has a question. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One, I'll try to make them quick, so as not to take too much time. When they were talking about lilacs, I wondered, would French lilacs fit into the, this isn't a disease question, but I wanted to ask it quickly. My mother gave me a French lilac shrub many years back, and I've never done anything with it. It's too tall, so the blooms are way up underneath a pine tree.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know I need to prune it back, but do I deal with that the same way in which you deal with the lilacs?
You certainly can, and right now is a perfect time to be out pruning those. What I would do is a controlled removal in your situation. You want to take really good pruning methods in your head when you're going out there to do it. So you're pruning so that you're leaving outward facing growth points so that you don't have the shrub growing inside. Otherwise, you're going to get your blooms on the inside if you get any at all. But if you don't prune now, it's going to be too late and you will cut off the buds for next year. So I would get out there and I would do it now. But certainly you can do that and just take it down pretty good. You can go down to easily about 4 feet with those at the top level and just clean them out very nicely and get in there and get out the oldest ones and you'll notice a huge difference.
And Alice, you had another question?
Yes. When you were talking earlier about trees and the loss of recommending removal of a tree having to be a therapist in this situation, I thought about a couple of experiences I had, and along with that, I wanted to ask about box elder bugs. We had a giant box elder tree in our backyard when I was a child. It was the yard. And it was huge. It had two big swing branches on it, the sandbox under it, everything. It was the yard. And when I came home from college one time, my parents had cut it down. And it was a huge depression, and I don't remember much discussion about it. But I thought to myself, gosh, now I wish I had a beautiful photograph of that tree.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend that if a tree that has sentimental value, that it at least a photograph be taken.
Sure.
If someone's going to be upset about it, that, I mean, this is iffy maybe because a similar thing happened to me. We had an ash tree in our yard. It wasn't a huge old tree, but when my daughter came home from college and we had cut it down because it was trying to enter the side door of the home, and it also had some splits in the bark, and one of the fellows who had done some pruning for me said, oh, that means the tree's going to die anyway, and so we cut it down, but my daughter said, I will never forgive you, Mother.
Alice, I'm going to have to ask you to hold it there. And we are having Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. It's Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and talking with Brian Huddleston, who is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, and Liz Freemuth, who is a horticulturalist, previously with Walworth County, and now the owner of The Garden Ho, a passion for healthy and happy plants. And we're really glad to have them back with us. And right before the break, we were talking about an issue with a box elder tree and whether box elder bugs actually damage those trees. What do you think?
Not really. No, I mean, they will do a little bit of feeding, but they are not intense enough to kill a tree unless it's on its last legs from something else. I know I had heard Phil on the show last week or this week, whenever it was.
And Phil Pelletieri, entomologist.
The bug dude. And really, they were very, very bad this year, and they were annoying to us. I would say they did more damage to my psyche over winter at our house than they would ever do to take a big box elder down. But box elder is really weak, weak tissued tree, and it doesn't take much to take a box elder out. Mm. Push it over with the car, you know, a little bumper push, and you can really take it out. So there are a lot of things that would hit it. I would not think that a box elder bug population is going to take
it
out at
all. It's not the sort of tree that we normally recommend that people plant. They oftentimes come up as volunteers, but Liz is giving me a hard time here.
Yeah, I'm smacking his head. We really, we don't, because there are a lot better choices mm-hmm. out there. But
they do come up as volunteers, and people do enjoy them.
And I have to say that I do have a really nice appreciation for their blooms when they're out mm-hmm. in early spring. And they're very pretty. If you don't go out and take a look at blooms on trees, you really should, because they're quite interesting and very, very lovely. Aside from that, no, have no use for them. They're messy trees, they're soft wood, and it's an easy tree. It pops up on its own.
Well, and that brings up a really good point, I think, because, of course, we do tend to inherit a lot of plants or trees mm-hmm. or shrubs when we, you know, take over a piece of land, whether it's a yard or, you know, some kind of community space. But if we're starting from scratch, mm-hmm. it sounds like there are some to avoid and some that are more disease resistant than others. Do you have, you know, a top three of disease resistant shrubs or plants that you would recommend if someone's starting with a clean slate?
The first one that comes to mind that I love that I have never seen a lot of disease problems on is ginkgo.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very slow growing. I love the history of the tree. It was thought to be extinct for a long time until China opened up, and then they found these trees growing in some of the monasteries and temples, and they're very, very ancient trees. They're actually gymnosperms, so they're not modern trees. They're very ancient trees.
They're kind of prehistoric trees.
But they have these lovely fan-shaped leaves. You can get some varieties that have, where the leaves are actually curled into kind of a tube.
Yes,
you can get others that are yellow variety. You definitely want to get a male, not a female.
Yes, I was going to mention that.
Well, but you know, yes, if you're kind of fussy about your yard,
yeah.
But the nuts are supposed to be delicious on, they're
slime
good.
That you have to
the
deal
slime.
With.
The slime.
And let's not forget the smell.
Okay, yes. but let's gross our listeners out tremendously and say that actually what is done in some civilizations, I personally am not going to do this, is you pick them up after they've gone through an animal system, and that takes all the goo out of the outside, but it does not... Their digestive systems do not dissolve that outer shell. So you can kind of wash them, roast them, and whatever. I can go there personally and get them, but they are supposed to be quite delicious and a delicacy in Asian countries.
I have to say, though, the Frank Lloyd Wright Home and Studio in Oak Park, Illinois, ginkgos figure prominently in Frank Lloyd Wright things. They have a gorgeous ginkgo tree in the courtyard, but it's a female. And you really have to kind of you have to take a big breath, kind of run past the tree. And it's incredibly pungent.
It can be a safety issue, though, too.
Yes,
and a lot
definitely,
of municipalities will ban female ginkgos because the sliminess of this material when it gets on the streets will cause problems with traffic as cars will slide in their accidents.
Well, there are so many to choose from because once they really became something that people could work with again, so many things to choose from. I've got a couple of dwarfies in my yard that only get about a foot high, and they have curled leaves on them and just absolutely beautiful. And I've got variegated, yellow variegated with a little bit of curl on the leaf edge, and really a lot to choose from. A very good plant.
But I think the architecture of the tree is quite interesting too, in terms of how the branches are formed. They are very slow growing, so you have to be patient with them.
What else besides ginkgos?
The other one that I really love is probably amelanchier or serviceberry.
That's a tough one.
Lovely spring flowering tree. It looks sort of like a crabapple, but I think the flowers are a little bit more delicate, and I think the leaves are more delicate as well.
Kind of a cross between a crabapple and not. The leaves are nicely oval. It's got a very soft look to the leaf. There's a little bit of pubescence, but not a lot. And it has fruit that's edible.
Yes.
And it's just coming out
They're
now.
They're actually delicious.
And, yeah,
if
and
the
if
birds
you,
don't get them
yeah.
first.
Yeah, you really do have to be tenacious to get out there and get the fruit off before the birds do, because they will beat you to it almost every day. One I absolutely love, and it's in flower right now. It's my absolute favorite shrub this week, is calycanthus. And that is Carolina sweet shrub. And it was thought to not be hardy for us up here, but we're finding zone 4 hardiness, and it's calycanthus, Florida's, and the best smelling one, there's two of them out there, well actually three, Athens is yellow flowering, and it really is the working man shrub because it flowers and is scented in the late afternoon, and so about 3 o'clock or so you'll get this scent of fruit bowl in your yard, and I mean sweet fruit bowl, and you don't know where it's coming from. And in fact, a couple of months ago I was down in Georgia visiting this beautiful yard of a retired fabric designer professor, and his yard looked like fabric design. It was beautiful, and I was standing there and I said, did you plant calycanthus someplace? And she said, no, we haven't planted it anywhere. And then she looked up, well, it grows native down there, and it was like 12 feet tall.
Wow.
And so these blooms were hanging over my head, and I could smell this fruit bowl thing, and little to nothing for problems. Deer don't care for it, which is a huge thing. They don't really bother the ginkgo much either. They don't bother amelanchier, and they don't bother the calycanthus much. If they nibble a little bit, it's on the very tips of the branches, and it flowers along the leaf node, so it doesn't matter if it loses just a little bit of the tip. But those are absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Just a few things to get started on.
The other thing that I have in my yard, which is always terribly disappointing from a plant pathologist standpoint, is my catsuar tree. It seems to be very, very healthy as well. So, I mean, keep in mind that I want diseases. So, I'm looking for diseases.
It's disappointing
pretty disease.
Too.
Yeah, pretty well, you know, disease-free.
There's one that we put in this little garden down in Delavan that I sit on the board for. It's a new botanic garden. It's just starting. And we put in some red fox catsuar tree, and Circeta phylum. And It is beautiful. It's more upright, and it's got red leaves when it opens up. And really,
it's have a beautiful
had,
tree.
Have had little to nothing problems
Mine's
with it at
huge.
All.
Mine's huge. I planted it about 20 years ago when I moved in my house, and it's very tall. In fact, I'm afraid it's going to hit the wires, the electrical wires, and they'll come and prune it to death.
And at the perennial plant of the year, because we can't forget perennials, even though, I mean, I tend to not look that far down because then I'll see the weeds that are growing in my yard. But Amazonia is a really good one. And Hubertia might be a little marginal for people in the Madison area, but Tabernae montana is going to be plenty hardy for here. It's got a wider leaf. And that one is really pretty tough. It's blue star flower, and it's flowering right now. And it does have a very nice blue color to it. Very good fall color, yellow, nice, beautiful yellow gold.
Great. I know we have some people that have been waiting to ask some questions, so let's go back to the phone. Denise in Walworth has a question. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I've read some articles and the book by Jeff Gilman about organic practices, and he suggests putting the plastic onto the soil in April, warming it up, and then I think he calls it solarization, killing everything in the soil. I was reluctant to do that this year in the vegetable garden. Do you know anything, like, are chemicals, bad chemicals, transmitted to the garden? Is it safe to eat?
So basically things that would leach out of the plastic.
Right.
Actually, it can be a good technique for destroying pathogens in the soil. If you live in the Middle East, where we get a lot of really hot, a lot of direct sun, in Wisconsin, it's not going to work as well, because we just don't get the temperatures and we don't have enough cloudless days to really get the soil temperatures hot enough for it to work. So definitely it's something you could try, but I would do it in combination with other sorts of techniques that are more cultural. So good fall cleanup and that sort of thing, and rotation. Definitely in a vegetable garden, you should be moving your vegetables from area to area so that you're not growing them in the same place all the time.
Yeah, and I do recommend it for removal of creeping Charlie and things like that that are horribly invasive, because you need a shorter period of time to accomplish that goal. Where with solarization, if you're trying to kill pathogens, and your word there is key when you said everything, it does kill everything in the soil. It's not just going to seek out dangerous or bad pathogens, it's going to kill all bacteria in the soil. So you're beneficials and you're not.
Mm-hmm. And it really won't get everything, but it's basically across the board.
Non-selective.
Yeah. Kind of like an antibiotic.
Exactly.
Right.
It just takes everything out.
That's right.
We had an email from Will in Partyville. He said, some of my Austrian pines have a problem where the needles turn brown and die, but the branch is still alive and produces a nice healthy candle every year. You can see that in the trees side by side. One is a showpiece and the other is a wreck. And he actually sent an email, which Jennifer, our on-air producer, put up on the Facebook page if anyone wants to see it. It's the Larry Mueller Show. And Brian took one quick look at that and knew exactly
what
it
was. Now, that's not an Austrian pine. That's a red cedar, and that particular disease, these big orange marmalade-y gelatinous blobs, that's a
They're
disease
awesome.
Called cedar apple rust. I love this time of the year because these big orange blobs start to form on junipers.
And they're gooey. They're gooey.
They look like big orange octopuses on the branches, and they're just great. It's a fungal disease, and it's actually an interesting fungus. It's a type of fungus called a rust, and this particular rust is what's called an alternating rust, because it spends part of its life on the junipers, like red cedar, and then those big orange arms are producing spores that don't reinfect the juniper. They infect rosaceous plants, so crabapples, hawthorn is a big host, and flowering quince are the big hosts in our area. And there's several variants of this particular organism, but this looks like it's probably true cedar apple rust.
And so what can he do about that?
I'd say have a cocktail party and enjoy looking at the globs on the trees. I'd illuminate them and I'd have a cocktail party.
That would be my
realistically
preference. Prune them out would be the thing that I would do. You can prune down about 4 inches below that gall if you don't like what it looks like. If you can kind of live through the few, maybe couple weeks that they're going to be around, then all you're left with is a little brown blob, and those are much less noticeable. The other thing you want to do is kind of decide whether you like junipers or rosaceous plants and grow only one of them. The worst thing you can probably do is grow a susceptible juniper around the base of a Crataegus, a hawthorn. Yeah.
And there's a lot of landscaping where that's been done, and you tend to get a lot of this disease. But you want to physically separate the junipers and the alternate hosts.
And I would say really take a look around in the neighborhood, too. If you're going to choose one of those to remove a host of some sort, take a look around the neighborhood and don't remove the one that everybody else has, because it can still go back and forth with a little bit of distance on there, you know, with neighbors right next door to each other.
Right. In urban settings, it's very difficult to physically separate the two hosts. What you can do, if you're not that attached to that sort of juniper, would be replace it. The Juniperus chinensis, Chinese junipers tend to have a lot of resistance, so that would be an alternative to. But this, I'm suspecting, is a red cedar, which is... very susceptible.
I've got a gray owl that doesn't get anything on it, and that one has been very, very resistant.
Is that a chinensis?
I honestly don't remember. I'd have to look it up. I bought it so that I could potentially have problems, and then I never had any problem with it. So I don't think it is. I will have to look that up. But I know gray owl, not a lick of problems.
Thanks for that. And let's go to Catherine in Wausau. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello?
Go ahead.
I have a question about hostas, a couple of questions. And is it true that you can use coffee grounds to ward off deer and diseases?
Deer, I don't know. I have never heard that they don't like the smell of coffee, but that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I don't know about that either.
I've never seen a study on that. So, you know, we'll put some teeth behind it. Not just that I haven't heard of it. I've never seen a study on that one.
Yeah, and I wouldn't expect coffee grounds to really be in any sort of good disease control, frankly.
Mm-mm.
I know that sometimes people add it to soil as a nutrient amendment, but not so much for disease control.
Oh, okay, but it's just good for the soil anyway, right?
Yeah, sure. It's to add fertility to the soil.
The only time I really kind of question whether I would want to put it out is if I've got a lot of wildlife in the area. If you have possums or raccoons and you've got coffee grounds with oils on them that are not going to come off completely in the brewing process, they may be attracted to it, but it's such a minor thing compared to throwing it out. You know, you may as well put it out and get some benefit from it again.
Well, I get it from Starbucks. They have it in big bags.
Yep. And they brew it hot enough that you're not going to have any residual left from much oil on it. But disease stuff, I haven't heard anything. And I'd say you'd have to ask Phil as to whether it does anything for slugs. I don't suspect the edges are sharp enough to rip the bodies on slugs. That's not something I've seen either.
And you had another question, Catherine?
Yep. And what about what causes the holes in hostas?
Now, that could be slugs.
More than likely slugs, yeah. And there are slug baits out there. You can also, you can increase airflow, but that doesn't really do much because slugs are pretty tenacious. They stick to the leaves, and increasing airflow just gives more space between them, so it takes them longer to crawl, and that's about it. There are some that are a little bit more susceptible to slug damage, others that they don't seem to bother much at all. Cleaning mulch out from underneath them so you don't give them a lot of hiding places, that can help. But otherwise, I would say if they're a huge problem, diatomaceous earth you can sprinkle out. That's got very sharp edges on it. It's a natural seed product, and it will slice their bellies open as they crawl over it, which can be somewhat satisfying from a gardener's perspective. But it sifts through the soil very, very easily, so you have to apply regularly, and that can be an issue. Otherwise, there are good slug baits out there that you can put around the base, and it will help take care of it.
You can also try beer. Definitely.
We like the beer.
Yeah. It might be better for you to drink the beer just so you don't care about the slugs.
But that might take care of it too. Yeah.
If you're going to try beer, what we recommend is get a kind of a flat bottom dish, like a pie plate that you can kind of bury down into the soil to the edge, and then put beer, and the richer the beer, the better. So the really
yeasty. It's
yeasty.
Got something that's very fragrant.
And that's attractive
smells fragrant,
to the slugs.
So slugs like good beer too.
Yeah.
They do. Well, and that's the kicker. Is people think, well, I put beer in once a week and I'm done. No, you have to put fresh beer in all the time because that's what they're attracted to is that yeasty. So, yeah.
And then
they might be slugs,
drown.
But they have good taste. They,
exactly. And then they go swimming in it.
Right.
And that takes care of it.
And they drown.
Yeah.
Now, I want to make sure that we get to talking about navigating the chemical aisle, which is how Liz phrased it when we were talking before the show. You know, a lot of us it's such a delicate balancing act. We want a healthy garden, but we also, like one of the earlier callers said, you know, we don't want to introduce any harmful elements, yeah. not just because it's things that we might be eating, but because there are kids around, pets around, wildlife. Mm-hmm. And so we want to keep as healthy an ecosystem as possible, but we also want to take care of those diseases or some of those pests. Where's the balance in there?
Oh, balance is always the issue. A couple of things that I would say right off the top is just because it says organic does not mean it's not harmful. So you do have to be very careful in reading any label you pick up as to how safe it is, what the reentry period, pre-harvest interval, all of the things that are on the label. But let's take a step even further back and say, have you properly identified the problem? Because if you haven't, you're not going to get a good recommendation on what product to use. So the first thing on navigating a chemical aisle is to decide whether you even need to be walking down that aisle. And that's identify the problem. Is it insect? Is it disease? Is it how you're taking care of it? You know, can you change your own practices culturally before you start putting a product down?
Right.
And if you can do that, you are really... You're really acting in a very sustainable fashion, because that is going to result in something that is going to have sustainable effects. There's going to be less input, and you don't have to worry, is it safe? You know, if that means changing your watering habit, it can be something like shut the irrigation off and only turn it on when we don't have 1 to 2 inches of rainfall a week, mm-hmm. and then only on newly planted things that don't have a shot at surviving. So to me, that's the first question. Do I need to be in this aisle or not? That's number one. And number two is, have I actually identified what the problem is? And then once you've identified the problem, know your enemy, know what you need to apply when. And just because you find a needle pathogen on your conifer does not mean you should be treating for it. Mm-hmm. So that's taking it to a professional and having a good assessment done. And if you're fairly knowledgeable, you can sometimes wade through the information. Brian's website has got a phenomenal amount of info on it that can help you make a good decision before you even step foot in that aisle.
And we're going to get that website up on the Facebook page. And Brian, why don't you give it now so mm-hmm. people have that?
If you want more information on diseases, you can go to my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. There's no www on the front of that. You'll end up at our food science department if you put the www there.
Well, that's interesting.
So pddc.wisc.edu.
And that's PDDC for Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic.
That's right. And when you get there, if you want to click, in our main menu, probably the easiest and best place to go is our publication section. We have about 201-page fact sheets on diseases, insects, general horticulture, weeds, and they're all available for you to browse. The other place you can go and find those, if you kind of know what you're looking for, as a great search engine, is our UW Extension Horticulture website, which is hort, H-O-R-T, dot U-W-E-X, for UW Extension, dot E-D-U.
And the other thing I want to say about navigating in chemical aisles, before I give my website out, is that, you know, don't go preventative on everything. If you don't have a problem, if you have never had one in the past, and it's not a serious issue that you're looking at, don't put a chemical on it if you don't have to. So there are great products out there, but you can't overapply. Plants can get used to it. Diseases can get used to it. Insects can get used to the products, and you will be applying and really building up resistance to when you actually need it. So do be a little bit careful with that.
And it's not cheap to apply these products
no,
either.
No, it is not.
In terms of either the cost of the product
not.
Or the time involved.
Yep, exactly. My website is www.thegardenho.com.
And that would be H-O-E.
H-O-E. thegardenho.com. There is only one. It is me. And there is a contact page on there where you can email me questions. I answer them usually 2:00 in the morning when I'm sitting with nothing else to do. And I do have a little box on my front page where when I remember to, I'll post stuff that's going on, you know, so plants that are flowering or things that I like, little stories here and there, funny. And it's usually self-deprecating, so you may enjoy it. So.
And we do actually have a link to The Garden Ho on the Facebook page. And the Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show. So you can get there, and we'll definitely get Brian's clinic link up
and my
there
contact
too.
Information is on my website as well.
Great. We have just a less than a minute left. Brian and Liz, thank you so much for joining us today. And, you know, it's amazing how many issues there are out there to keep on top of in the garden.
Glad to be here.
There really are. And Brian and I are so happy to help people. So it's fantastic. Thanks for having us.
Sure. And we're glad to have you along. On Monday, I'll be talking with Peter Green of InfoStar. He'll be able to offer help on your personal computer issues. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.